This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm conducting an oral history interview with Colonel Roger H.C. Donlan. Today is October 24th, 2005. It's approximately 9:40 a.m. Central Standard Time, and both of us are in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University in the Vietnam Archive interview room. And Colonel Donlan, before we begin, we did sign the interview agreement before we began this interview, so you are freely consenting to participating in the Vietnam Oral History Project.
That's correct.
During this interview. Thank you, sir. Why don't we begin with some basic biographical information about yourself. Could you tell me where you were born and when you were born and a little bit about your early childhood years?
Born on 30 January 1934 on the corner of Main and Minders Street. That's M-Y-N-D-E-R-S-E.
Okay.
In Saugerties, New York. And that's our home. And of the 10 children in our family, 9 were born at home. And I was one of those.
Where is exactly Saugerties?
Saugerties is in the Catskill Mountain Range area. It's a little over 100 miles north of New York City, on the west side of the Hudson River. So other historic marks there. The military academy is south of us, about 40 miles.
About 40 miles away.
Yeah. So,
okay.
It puts it in the state capital, Albany, is about 40 miles north. So we're in a great location.
Yes. 10 children. Where were you in that, that bunch?
I was actually number 7.
Okay.
There lost one before me and after me, so 8 children survived.
Okay. And tell me how many brothers, how many sisters?
There were 6 boys and 4 girls.
Okay.
So 5 and 3 of us.
Right.
I was born into a situation that was not unique. If you take 1934, it's right on the heels of the Great Depression.
Yes.
The Donlan family was rather well off because of my grandfather's initiative, who came from Ireland to establish his business, and his coal and lumber business, and feed. And my father took over that business.
So your grandfather immigrated from Ireland?
Ireland, right.
And set up this business?
Right, so in the mid-1800s. And so by the time I came along, and my older brothers and sisters, the family was well established. The corner, the house where we lived, Daddy built a whole block of homes. And we always took great pride in that.
So he
but with the Depression and fire, lost everything. So we lived in a nice home, but under austere conditions. Like so many people at the time, they experienced true hunger. Mm-hmm. It was not uncommon, as it might be today, but hand-me-downs was the common experience mm-hmm. that people. And that was hand-me-downs for everything, whether it be school books or your clothes and your shoes. If the shoes were too big, you stuffed them with paper and you still wore them.
I imagine in your family you had a good hand-me-down chain with your brothers and sisters.
There certainly was, yeah. Of course, I had, before Daddy died, he gave me my but I still consider it the greatest birthday gift I ever got. It was my 10th birthday, and he gave me 50 baby chicks.
Really?
And he asked me to bring them up in the box and show them. He was in bed. They all sounded good, and he talked to me about, it's likely that some will have rickets and might not survive, so you have to cull them out. But he, at that point, as I look back now, he was saying, okay, I'm going to entrust you but the responsibility to raise these, because you know where our main meal of the week comes from, and it's the chicken coop. And throughout the week, it's the eggs. Whatever you can do to raise money by selling eggs would be helpful too. So all of that, and, as I look back, that was a great lesson. But I dreamt about being able to do that, and I used to go to chicken coop with him, you know, and gather. I didn't gather eggs. I wasn't big enough. He was waiting in line. Daddy had a way of letting you earn your way to perform a chore, an essential chore, some more essential than others around the house.
Mm-hmm.
Taking out the garbage, you could be any age. I used to say, man, I hope I live long enough to never have to take out the garbage again. But every Sunday night, I still think about that.
Do you really?
Taking out the garbage. But those baby chicks became a big thing in my life, because I raised them. And, talking about hand-me-down clothes, a little aside is that my mother would say, Roger, when the feed man comes, let me look at the feed bags. They used to have colored cloth on the feed bags. This was during the war.
Mm-hmm.
And it would come in different patterns. So my mother would say, get one of those, because I had one of those last month. Because she would take those feed bags and make dresses for my sisters.
Wow.
My sisters weren't too excited about that. But
they had the dresses.
It was necessary. They had something. And mother, having been in an environment earlier in her life and in her wedded life also, she had a lot of variety, and she knew what variety meant in girls' attire.
Mm-hmm.
But I think my sisters today would still punch me if I raised that issue up. Mother making dresses out of feed sacks.
It's very revealing for the times.
Yeah. Well, and they hated to wear it to school, but when they got there, they found out that, you know, the lucky thing, the girl had feedback on, but it wasn't the same design.
Tell me a little about your father. What kind of man was he, and person was he? And
yeah. The daddy was the eldest of his family. And in those days, the tradition, whatever the family was involved in, that was kind of, the eldest son was expected to continue.
Right.
And his four brothers all were sent off to college. He was the only one that did not go to college. He assumed the reins of family business. And I never knew from him or any of my uncles or any of the family ever mentioned that, if he ever felt shortchanged on that. I don't think so. Although Daddy, with the Depression and fire, destroyed the business not once but twice, and then there was no way to get back up. And the time I came along, he was hurt. He was wounded. And an illness. Very quiet. Rarely raised his voice. He had the fastest draw in the East. And that was with his belt. You see the old Western movies, the fast draw. Well,
right.
Daddy would be sitting reading the newspaper, and if one or more of us were raising cane around the house, and if it was necessary to get our attention, he could very subtly unbuckle his belt and not even drop the newspaper, and simultaneously drop the newspaper and one of us going by, and he'd snap us in the butt with that belt and quiet down. You know, that'd be about. He never cursed. I heard him say, I think he said damn once. He never used profanity. He seemed to be most at peace when we were out in the chicken coop or working in the garden. Loved to be outdoors. For each child born into the family, he planted another fruit tree in the yard, someplace on the property. And mine was a pear tree, and it's still alive and still bearing fruit.
That's neat.
71 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in fact, I have to get go home and prune it good, get it go for another 50 years. But we had apple trees and cherry trees and pear trees and a great big grape arbor. He would let me sit by as he split wood for the fire. We had a coal and wood burning stove in the kitchen and a coal and wood burning furnace for the house. But our coal and wood burning stove also had gas, which was really uptown for the times. And but you had to earn, as far as the furnace, the hot water heater, and the kitchen stove, you had a chain of responsibility that you could work up. You'd haul the ashes first, and then you'd learned from one of my older brothers to rat hole the ashes during the winter, get a big bucket out back in the garage or the chicken coop and keep some of those ashes, because invariably there'd be a car or truck going around the corner and they'd get stuck, and you can go out and help them, and they always tipped you. You were never asked for money, you were just to help them, but you're good for a nickel or a dime or maybe even a quarter. So I learned that from my brother, that you could be helpful, but you had to be prepared that way. And I couldn't wait till the time I could split wood. It took a while. I think I was 10 before I could use a hatchet, not an axe.
Before he would allow you, or before you were physically?
No, before he permitted.
Okay.
Yeah, because he didn't want any his kids missing fingers. One older brother, in fact, Paul, was known not to be the most handy guy. I don't know if he ever got permission to use the hatchet or the axe.
No matter his age?
Yeah. And then there was a two-man saw.
Wow.
God, that was something. And you really had to grow into that job. So my associations with Daddy were out in the yard, in the garden, in the chicken coop. I remember I saved enough money to get a new pair of galoshes, the type that had the metal snaps that go across.
Yes.
There are about four or five snaps, and they're halfway up your calf. And really proud of those things, and I still hadn't gotten permission to collect the eggs because the nests were high enough, and Daddy said, well, you can't afford to mess up and drop any of these eggs, but I'll let you know when you can collect. So going out with him one morning, and I had my new galoshes on, feeling great about having saved the money from the eggs. And he said, hey, Roger, I can let you collect some eggs here this morning. So he handed me a basket before we opened this little door into the chicken coop. And as I stepped in my nice shiny galosha, the first thing that did, it caught the attention of the biggest rooster in there. He just pecked at it and cut a slice in there, and I did, and I got so excited and mad, and I dropped the basket. That was before I was to collect eggs. And Daddy just picked up the basket and went on and collected eggs, never said a word. And I said, man, I don't know if I did. I probably did cry, because I knew I had spent a lot of money, or all my money, to get those galoshes.
What color were they?
They're black, shiny black galoshes. This old rooster was Plymouth Rock, black and white. He was mean. He didn't get any less mean, because after that, any chance I had, I'd drop kick him out of the way. With, if he was in foot's distance of me, I'd let him give him a boot, and that made him meaner. So, one of my brothers came home on leave, and it was the springtime, and I had the chickens. I let them out in the yard, and this old rooster was there. My brother Jack came. He gets off the bus on the corner, and he comes around back. Hey, Rod, see, you got your chickens out? Yeah. And this old rooster spotted him, a new pair of shiny shoes, and took pursuit. What's going on here? This damn rooster's chasing me all over the place. So, didn't get his shoes. But Daddy and I often share this with people. On lessons in life, even as a youngster, and of course being down towards the end of the list, I could hear him telling and guiding my older brothers and sisters, is always remember that your word is your bond, and that your signature is a seal to that. And as I first heard it, you know, I didn't fully understand or appreciate it, but as time went on, that's been one of the most valuable lessons in life that I could get from anyone. And that was Daddy, and he believed that, and he lived that. And then he always would point out, is there's no shame in hard work. In fact, it's good for the soul, and working with the earth is great. There's a pleasure working with the earth that only those who have done it will really know and appreciate. And then he was always supportive of Mother. And Mother was our spiritual guide.
Mm-hmm. You all were Roman Catholic?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And in the family, you know, Daddy had a sister that was a nun, my mother had a sister that was a nun, and of course there was always that, it was never discussed, but always implied that somebody in our group was going to go into the clergy, mm-hmm. whether a nun or a priest, you know. And then aunts were always visiting, and they bring, in those days, aunts, nuns, and always traveled in pair. Mm-hmm. And always in uniform, mm-hmm. so it was a big event when one of the aunts would show up with her mother superior or a classmate from the novitiate or convent. And,
right.
And they have their long habits on, and man, they had big pockets in there. And we'd always hover around waiting to see what surprise they'd pull out. It was like a grab bag, they would always pull out. They bait you with candy first, and then the religious items, articles would come out. Well, you have to have one of these. I got one for each of you. I always seemed to get the card that was a special prayer to St. Jude. And St. Jude is known as the patron saint of hopeless cases.
Did you take that personally?
So I didn't realize it until later on. Heard the stories about all these. I enjoyed the stories, and they were kind of exciting. As a kid, I remember we had a book, The Lives of the Saints, and there was not just, it was written in a way, it wasn't just their spiritual dimension, it was their life's dimension, and many of them had participated in some type of combat. In fact, the most famous in my mind is Saint Ignatius, and he's the founder of the Jesuit mm-hmm. order, mm-hmm. was one of the most disciplined and scholarly orders mm-hmm. of any clergy. But before he entered priesthood, he was a soldier of renown, mm-hmm. and I always enjoyed the stories. Saint Isaac Job, he was martyred by the Mohawk Indians. He was a Mohawk of the Iroquois in upstate New York. I couldn't read his story until I was older. I wasn't permitted.
Who was this again?
St. Isaac Job, I believe it was. I'd have to double check.
Okay.
Yeah. He was a Jesuit missionary. Part of the torture was pulling his fingernails out and making him dig his own grave. There's a shrine in a place called Orrisville, New York, I think. But
you see, your father seems like he was a very patient man, and with a large family, he would have to be. And that he was the cliche, the salt of the earth kind of human. When you think of him right now, what do you see?
Certainly a patient individual, but the older I get, I see a man that had great love, but I always feel that I never got to know him, because I was just 12 years old. He was rugged. His skin it looked like leather, because he was outdoors, worked outdoors his whole life, and loved the outdoors. And sometimes when he'd be finished the work, and he instructed me, when you finish a job, go check it out, make sure you got it, meets your standards. And he would, just doing the lawn even, he would, after it's finished, he'd walk around, look at it, almost like he was in meditation. And maybe he was, saying, thank God that's done.
Right.
I wish these kids would grow up so they could do it. Or they'd stay around long enough to do it. So that's... But he had a hand and arm signal. Sometimes when things got a little chaotic, usually when I was harassing my younger sister or something, or Brother Gerard, the next eldest, he and I were into something together, he'd just put his hand up and four fingers. We had already gotten the message verbally by being asked, what's the fourth commandment? Remember the fourth commandment. Honor your mother and father. So he was saying, hey, quiet down, show some respect, honor your mother. And I think he implied also, I'd like to read the newspaper in peace.
Right.
Yeah. He enjoyed the comic strips, and we would be in the house someplace or hiding behind the sofa, my sister and I, and Daddy would be reading the paper, and he'd give you chuckling. But it's one of the comic strips, and we didn't know what he was chuckling at, although he was on the page for the comic strips, and that would get us chuckling. It was good. That made us happy to hear him chuckle, because he wasn't the provider that he was at one time for the family, because of his health. So in the last years, he was very, I wouldn't say unhappy, he was unsatisfied with himself, but not a cheerful. But being a young kid, you didn't focus on that too much.
What was wrong with him? What was his illness?
Cancer. Colon cancer finally got him, but he suffered a lot at home. There was no money for medication, hospitalization, other things health-wise in the family. I had an elder sister that came down with the scourge of the day, which was tuberculosis. And so the little monies that there were that got her some medical care, but then she ended up having to go to a TB asylum, and she was away from home, so didn't get to know her that much as an older sister. But
how old were you when your father died?
I just turned 13. Yeah, 12. 1947. Yeah.
How did that impact you at 13 years old?
Oh, I was mad at the world. It seemed like he'd been really sick in bed for 3 years or more. So the highlight for he and I had been those chickens. And, they were doing well. And there was one of my boyhood friends, his mother was a nurse. And she was a gal with a big, big heart, Mrs. Ball. And she would just volunteer to come up and help mother and take care of daddy. I think, to be quite honest, when daddy died, I became what they call, what's the current label they put on kids at risk? I became a loose cannon in some respects. And the fourth commandment kind of fell off the screen because I did what I wanted to do, and I stayed out late, ran with the wrong guys, skipped, we had some traditional days. We'd skip school, everybody, or first day of spring every day, every year. We just wouldn't show up at school. We'd go to the woods or someplace, or try and find a lake and get the first swim in. But I gave mother a lot of headaches. And as a result, didn't apply myself as I should have in school. Grade school through the eighth grade, I did well. In fact, it was almost expected because tail end Charlie, all the Donlins always had A's and 100%.
Mm-hmm. Was that pressure on you as
well? Yeah, as a kid. And, but I. It just became one thing. I didn't look at it as pressure, I don't think. The school. We went to a parochial school, mm-hmm. and Sisters of Charity, of which my father's sister was a Sister of Charity, and an aunt, great aunt, was a Sister of Charity also. Mm-hmm. So,
before we move there, let me ask you a couple of other questions about your family. Mm-hmm. You said you lost one brother and one sister. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about that? What happened?
To the best of my knowledge, one was, Marion was before me, and that was my mother's namesake. And she died at birth. And then Joseph was after me, and my understanding that he died of scarlet fever.
Okay.
Yeah. So none of the family have any recollection. Even recently, talking with my older brothers, I said, well, gee, you know, we heard, and mother used to include in our prayers, you know, would be going down the litany of family relatives, and then Marion and Joseph would be, and nobody ever questioned who was that. And it just went on, and in fact, one or two of my brothers and sisters say, oh no, there was nobody like that. Because, well, one of these days I will dig out death certificates, mm-hmm. and validate that. That's as I understood it. Mother always, and she, like I mentioned, was the spiritual guide.
Yes, tell me about her. Who was she? What kind of person was she?
Oh, gosh. She was a city girl, born in Brooklyn. And her best friend from school and work days, I guess, used to travel to the country. Her name was Gertrude Getty, I believe. She's a big, big lady. Tall in stature and big, hefty. Mm-hmm. And that was an annual event. Gertrude would come to visit, mm-hmm. to see her old friend Marion with her, all her children running around. Gertrude never married, to my knowledge, and became a very high, early female executive in a big company, oil company. But so Mom came up with her to the country once, and Gertrude wanted to introduce her to my uncle Mike, mm-hmm. who was the live wire of my father's family. He sang and danced and played all the musical instruments, from the ukulele and the piano, clarinet, spoke. He took his courses in college in English and Greek, and decided he wanted to learn Chinese too, so he cornered a local Chinese laundry man and said, "I'll teach you English and teach me Chinese, and give me free laundry." Mm-hmm.
So he was going to be your mother's blind date.
Then she saw this other guy who was more reserved and quiet. I guess that started in 1924. They were married in 1924. So they got married in New York City. Uh-huh. At the it was an old Spanish chapel, parish. I forget, Father Adrian was officiated at it, and that was another annual event. He would always come to visit once a year, usually in the summer, mm-hmm. and he'd go up to Trinca's Lake. That was a little lake not too far away. Mm-hmm. He was an amazing guy. We'd go watch him. He'd get on a horse and he'd ride like a wild man. Even at age 90, he came. He rode the horse, not so wild, but he didn't hesitate in climbing a tree and then diving into the lake.
Wow.
Yeah, he's a great old guy. And my mother was the catalyst of these visitations by the clergy, so to speak. And at meals, are you there too? You had to earn the right to say grace. And it usually came about the time, for the guys anyway, when they were old enough to become altar boys, acolytes. And then the challenge there was to learn Latin. In those days, Mass was celebrated in Latin. So
right.
In fact, I shared the other night at the Navy Reserve banquet the story about my mother's influence, and she said, "Well, when you're ready, I'll let you say grace." So one day, my Aunt Grace, her sister, was visiting, and with a fellow nun, they were Sisters of Mercy. They had a different uniform than mother.
Mm-hmm.
So they're sitting around the lunch table, and his mother says, "Well, Roger, would you like to say grace today?" "Oh, yes, Mother."
This was the first time?
First time, yeah.
A little pressure there with the visitors.
Yes, oh, this is really... So there's nice, reverent silence, and I blurted out, and I says, "Nay, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, or each of the fasting gets the most." Oh, God. The silence persisted, except for my brother Gerard, my sister Barbara snickering and laughing. And then I got the evil eye from my mother and my aunt and the other visiting nun. So I had to start over.
How old were you then?
Oh, probably 10. maybe a little younger.
Uh-huh.
Maybe 9 or so. And when I shared that story the other night, I says, "Well, that's when I take a back azimuth on my life, I says I realize now that was a moment that my compass really went off course.
But a typical 10-year-old, you know.
Couldn't resist. That same nun, Aunt Ruth, on one of her visits, I remember I was out in the garden, and Daddy was picking the beans, and I was picking tomatoes. And I had a basket full of tomatoes, and I said, oh, I have to finish this row, and I'll get these other few, and I stuck them in my shirt, and then just a couple in there. And we noticed Aunt Ruth, her traveling buddy, coming up the front sidewalks, and ran in the house, put the basket of tomatoes on the table, and Daddy put the bag of beans up there, and we went out and we greeted them. Aunt Ruth was sitting in there, and they were in summer uniform. They used to wear whites.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, kind of looked like a ghost. But I jumped up on her lap, and she gave me a big hug, and then all of us said, uh-oh!
You've been found out.
I had a tomato still stuck in my shirt. Got smushed a little bit. So I don't know how she explained her stain on her uniform when she got home. But she had a witness there, so it was okay, I guess.
You had a lot of religious figures around you during your childhood, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, we all were excited and looked forward to the day that we would be able to become acolytes and serve. And we all went to parochial school. So it was a big part of our upbringing. And we had a great little parish. It was geographically the last parish for the greater New York City diocese. And as such, the cardinal would visit on occasion. And if you were serving when he came, that was a high honor for
him.
And I think I was maybe in eighth or maybe even ninth grade. I don't remember when. But it was midnight mass and he was there. And I was given the privilege to be the one that would hold his mitre. We used to call it a dunce hat. This is the conical shape of it. You know, and I'm standing there holding that, and he'd come down, he'd troop the line and conduct an inspection before service. And everybody's in uniform or red ties and white, what we call it. We had the cassock and then the right white blouse over it. And big stiff starch collars and cuffs. And it was pretty sharp looking, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm standing there, and I guess the closer we got to him, the more nervous I got. I didn't realize it was nervous, but it was. He got in front of me, and I guess I tightened up, and that old might have popped open, you know, pop! and he just kind of smiled, yeah. And he went on, didn't say anything. And then he backed off, and he surveyed all of us, and we probably had 20 in the ceremony that night. That was the biggest event of the year. And he says, well, yes, I know you all been instructed on what to do and when to do it. He says, just remember, if you don't remember what to do, just look like you know what you're doing.
That's interesting memory.
Yeah. Well, years later, and I'll jump away ahead, and this was, golly, in the 60s, late 60s, maybe early 70s, probably late 60s, I found myself at Valley Forge, Freedom's Foundation, where they were dedicating the All Faiths Chapel. And I was invited, and who was there? Part of it was Cardinal Spellman.
Oh, this is the Cardinal.
The Cardinal, Spellman. Francis Cardinal Spellman. So, he was always known, he had great love for the military. In fact, on many occasions, he confessed to people, well, if the good Lord didn't put me in this uniform, I'd sure be in yours. So we were in Dr. Wells, who was the president of the Freedom Foundation at the time. I think he may have been a founder. In his home, changing, kind of getting into dress blues, and mm-hmm. Cardinals across the hall getting into his robes. And about the same time, coincidentally came out in the hall at the same time, I kind of looked at him. I said, it's been a long time since I've seen you in that uniform. And he looks at me and he says, well, when was that? And I says, well, Midnight Mass, 1940 what? And he says, oh my God. Yeah, and he says, oh, I've longed to be in your uniform even then. And then we had a great visit. Uh-huh. He's a really wonderful, wonderful guy. So all those experiences as a youngster in the association with the church and the shenanigans we pulled as altar boys. And another time my aunt was visiting, mm-hmm. and she smirks, she says, Roger, are you going to say grace today? And I says, no, Aunt Ruth, not today. She says, but you know something? I found out something really interesting. Last Saturday, I went over to help Father to get ready for Sunday Mass. And I walked in unexpected, I think, and I found out how they make holy water now. She says, you did? Well, that's probably something that shouldn't be discussed. You know, and she was kind of just cutting me off and hushing me up, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then one of my brothers says, well, how'd they do that, Roger? I said, they boiled the hell out of it. Of course, he fell off his chair laughing. And my aunt, again, was aghast.
Right.
The old pastor had been there for ever since I can remember. He was not a missionary, but he came from Ireland. Father mm-hmm. O'Hardy, great big jolly guy with an accent as thick as like the first day he got off the boat, mm-hmm. and it never changed. And he never missed an opportunity, no matter whether it was an ordinary mass, a solemn high mass, a nuptial mass, or a requiem mass. He would find a moment, an opportunity to remind everyone. And please, he would say in his Irish brogue, please remember to pray for the boys and gals in service. Huh. And I got to the point where I always kind of waited, and it never came at the same time. Mm-hmm. Whenever he was so moved or remembered or mm-hmm. whatever, but it was always genuine. And service was became, I think, byline for me, and he helped plant the seed. That goes back to Daddy, because we, around the dining room table, we talked in the litany of prayers of who was mentioned. Mm-hmm. There was always everybody was in service. My Uncle Eddie, who I never got to know, mm-hmm. my mother's brother, he was gassed in World War I. Daddy served in World War I. Then there was some discussion about, oh, you remember the service flag that Grandma made? And that's where the service flag, where a tradition started in World War I, where the family would have a blue star and a white field around that star, and then around all of that, a red border. Mm-hmm. And then a gold fringe from the bottom. Mm-hmm. And then there was string on top so they could hang it on a nail or something and display it in their home when they had some in the service. I never saw the one they had for Daddy and my Uncle Francis.
Your grandmother made this?
Yeah. That was common that day. That was, the families made those things. And I always wished, boy, we'd stumble upon it in a locker or a box or something. But Right. We never did. And it was during the war. My brother Paul went in right out of high school, drafted the next day, I guess.
My
oldest brother.
Okay.
Named after Daddy.
Your father's name is Paul.
Yeah, Paul Augustin. And my brother was Paul Augustin Ignatius Donlon. Yeah. He used to say, yeah, I'm going to get a license plate, put my number on it, my initials on it, and the number 4 afterwards.
Yeah.
Paid for. But I remember one time, Mother was a daily communicant. She always found a way to walk to church. And I can never remember my mother ever being sick.
Oh, really?
She never took a day off. And she would always start the day by walking to church, and that was 2 long blocks to get there. Any weather conditions, she would still manage to go. And then one of us would always accompany her. And I remember coming back one morning, I think it was winter. I said, Roger, when we get home, I'd like you to help me with something. I said, here comes another chore. And when I got home, she said, she went into one of the drawers in the dining room. She pulls out a service flag. She said, let's put this up for Paul in the front window. So we had 3 windows in the front. Mm-hmm. So we stuck it there, thumbtack. That's the new version of what they had in World War I. And it seemed like another day or so, but it was months later, maybe even a year. We put another one up for my brother Mike, and then we always, the intensity of the prayers increased because we hoped that the blue star would never turn gold, symbolizing killed in combat. And our prayers were answered. Paul came back wounded. Mike made it back unscathed. He got into the tail end of the war. We have there's a picture of both of them. They met in, if they met in Europe before he left or not. I don't know how that came about.
What branch of the service were they in?
They were both Army. Yeah. And Paul served with the 3rd Infantry Division, 30th Regiment. His baptism of fire was on Anzio, which is one of the most fierce battles of World War II. Mm. And he was a machine gunner. And he always says, oh, I was a lousy soldier. He says, sometimes I didn't even shoot my gun. And that was not uncommon. Newly on battlefields, fear or fright, they'd freeze. Mm-hmm. And then events would evolve, and then they would become a fighting member of the team. Mm-hmm. And he always criticized himself for, he remembers there were times that he froze up. But he got wounded up in a place called Saint-Di, France, about mid-France. And was left on the battlefield, and the squad leader was, when we were clearing the area, was just making a sweep back over where they'd been. And saw him. Thought he was dead, he was unconscious. And checked him out and said, hey, yeah, he's still alive. Picked him up, threw him over his shoulders, and carried him off. I said, I owe my life to that guy. He could have kept on walking.
Sure.
And I would have never known the difference. And I've always encouraged Paul to go to his unit reunions. And last year was the first time he went to one. And I talked to him recently, and I think he's coming there. So he's 80 years old.
Wow.
But I think, and my other brother Mike is finally, he's got a couple of his. Mm-hmm. They've, for one reason or another, and they they didn't go to reunions. And Paul kicks himself in the butt now. He said, I wish I had, because I probably would have met my old squad leader, because I found out he lived quite a few years later. And he remembered his name and everything. And so taking those back azimuths on life and reflect, have a value, various measured in various ways for people. Here today we're doing it for the preservation of history, maybe, but for everybody individually, taking back azimuths on life and touching base on it, I think helps us keep things in perspective and on course. And I think everybody should do it for themselves.
Who taught you that? Is this something that you came to realize?
I think, yeah. I don't think I was ever instructed. I think I, because of what's happened to me, and I found myself sharing my military experiences, I chose to share them in a way that reflected where I came from in life, why I chose a life of service, who influenced me that way. Daddy, my brothers, all my relatives, every arm of our families, there was somebody in the service from World War One on. Mm-hmm. And I felt an innate desire to do that. I felt almost obligated, mm-hmm. in a sense. And I truly believe there is an obligation for everyone to serve. I regret we don't have a draft today, but that's a political issue, and I don't think we'll ever have another draft unless there's such a national crisis that's on our soils to a magnitude that there is no other recourse than mm-hmm. to call everybody, man, mm-hmm. woman, and child. Mm-hmm. And that was my upbringing. Every man, woman, and child was involved in World War II, mm-hmm. you know. We had paper drives sponsored by the church, scrap metal drives sponsored by our Boy Scout troop. The school, we would have paper drives as well. I can still smell hot dogs being boiled in the basement of the school. That was a big treat, because that was meat for the week, mm-hmm. and bean soup, chocolate milk, which sometimes went sour in these little pint bottles. That was what we got during the war. Things got tough. I remember you talk about empty cabinets. I've seen empty cabinets, and mother performed miracles on how she would stretch the food to put something on all the plates. Mm-hmm. Then some miracles would happen. A bag or a box of groceries would be on the back steps. Somebody knew our plight and would, just out of kindness, would drop it off. A Christmas tree would show up laying on the front porch. Years later, I found out who it was. It was my godmother and my godfather.
Really?
The Dale family. They knew our plight, and they would we'd see him at church, and we'd always, you know, Aunt Mary, Uncle Charlie, and we'd say hello and chit chat. Mm-hmm. I think they used to look at us and measure how hungry we looked. And said, "Man, the kids didn't look so good. Let's put some groceries on the back steps right. next time we go by or something."
Right.
And that was the type of atmosphere we grew up in. And because mother was convinced, and she did her best to convince us, that's the power of prayer. It was the hand of God working. and it's ironical how I'd heard that in my upbringing. And my wife, when things happened in almost mysterious way, to us as individuals or the family and family members, Norma will say, well, looks like it's the hand of God again. You know, so I'd have to be honest and say faith has been the principal cornerstone in my life. And we're blessed to, it was tough in a large family, and like I said, hungry and hand-me-downs and scraps here and there, but Mom always used to say, a family that prays together and stays together. Used to have blackouts during the war. Mm-hmm. Mother would say, oh, it's the hand of God. Yeah, blackout, all be quiet, just kneel down wherever you are. The curtains, the shades would be pulled, mm-hmm. No lights on. And she'd start recitation of the rosary. Yeah. Of course, I'd crawl around and grab a hold of my sister's pigtail or something,
right,
in the dark. I guess maybe that's some of my first night training.
Let me ask you about your father in World War I. What did he do?
Yeah. He was in a quartermaster.
Okay.
And his headstone, you know, we didn't have any money for buy a headstone. Mm-hmm. And a quarter, the government provided one. And it's a little flat headstone. And I saw it was PFC, Paul A. Donlan, quartermaster. World War I. Mm-hmm. And about a year ago, I said, I'm going to try to find Daddy's records. Because Norma wanted to look up some records about her family, mm-hmm. and found out that if a member is deceased, the National Archives is to have anything, they will, if you're proven member of the mm-hmm. family, they'll release those. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, I'll try. So I tried to get Daddy's records, and they sent them. And I didn't know that he was medically discharged for hypothyroid, mm-hmm. I don't know what it was, something. So he was only, he was not deployed overseas, but he, I'm sure, was placed in the quartermaster, the Navy calls it stores, because of his background, upbringing. He was raised in the logistics or stores business,
yes,
lumber and feed and,
yes,
hardware. So it was a natural place for him.
So it was the U.S. Navy?
Yeah. No, he was Army.
Oh, he was Army.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just using it because, okay, of the last week associating with the Navy.
Yes.
It says, quartermaster. What do you guys call quartermaster? Oh, you mean stores? I said, well, that sounds right.
Did he talk about his service? Or
no, never. And to this day, I have not found a picture of him in uniform. Hmm. That's what I wanted to get. I found recently Uncle Eddie, who was gassed, a picture of him in uniform. I'm trying to get a picture of everybody in the family that mm-hmm. served, mm-hmm. immediate family and cousins, mm-hmm. uncles. And then throw all the nuns in their different uniforms because they're served for a lot. You know, it wasn't a period for draft. It wasn't a period for 20 or 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they knew what service was.
Yes.
And they lived it. And they lived it beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When I got, it's jumping ahead a little bit, but when I got called and informed to be at the White House, and they said, well, who would you like to be there? And I said, family and the team, of course. Is there anybody else? And, you know, my old boss, the old general, and his wife. Anybody else? Yeah, Aunt Ruth. Yeah. So he said, okay, we're going to take care of it. So there she was. Aunt Ruth was there. Well, I called her up. I said, Aunt Ruth, you're going to be getting a call. You're going to get invited to go to the White House on the 5th of December. She said, Roger, you're pulling one of your jokes again.
She didn't know.
No. Well, I just found out.
Right.
And she said, what are you pulling jokes now? What's this one? I said, no, it's not a joke. I just got called. And they asked me, who would I like to have there? And I'd like to have there. And I know Mother would be happy if you were there, since Daddy's not going to be there. you know I can't go alone. I said, well, I have to get permission all the way up to Mother Superior. So what? Just tell her she's invited.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an idea.
And she came?
The Mother Superior shows up with Aunt Ruth, the White House, and there they are too in uniform. And afterwards she told me, well, you got me good, Roger. She says, how's that? She says, I had to write the after action report. I said, well, the Mother Superior wasn't going to do it. Yeah, she's great. During the war, she was always a great correspondent, Aunt Ruth. And throughout my whole life, you know, she never missed your birthday and things like that. And, but at one point, I guess, maybe it was after I got back, the class picture, fourth grade, they sent me a class picture, and all the kids signed it on the back. And one of my goals is to find all those kids and think, I think I might just go back to the school and say, hey, you put this out to your alumni letter somehow to say thank you.
Mm-hmm.
It's become one of my goals in life is to thank all the people who have touched my life one way or another, mostly in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
But a few in negative. But mother and daddy, God, were brave. And mother lived, 30 years as a widow. They never complained. She's always very devout and reverent. If you came home unexpected, and she wasn't doing a chore around the house, she was always in her favorite chair, and she was in the prayer mode. She prayed for everybody on earth. I remember when Woodstock, well, in order to get to Woodstock, many had to go right by our front door, the highway.
Wow.
So, mother sitting on the front porch, she wrote me a letter. She said, oh, Roger, I'm sure you're glad not here to see this. She says, we talked about God never made a mistake. Then she'd say, print, but, and she never went on from there, implying that somebody made some mistakes.
Right.
She says, oh, God. Hey,
What year did she pass away?
Oh, dear.
In the 1970s?
Yeah, 76, 77, 77. Yeah, I was commanding in Panama. And she passed away, and I didn't get home in time. But it was interesting. Her mother, her sister, her two sisters, and her brother all passed on their 81st birthday. Not birthday, year.
In the year.
Year.
Wow.
So they all in their 80s. And grandma might have been. Grandma was something. I used to go as a kid. That was a big thing. If we could save up enough money to get on the bus, the Greyhound bus, and go down to New York and spend a week or two with my grandmother, my mother's mother.
Mm-hmm.
Dad's parents had already passed, and grandfather had passed on the mother's side. But that was during the war, I remember the first time.
Down to Brooklyn?
Yeah, well, actually in the Bronx, they moved. She was born there. They lived on Post Road, 252nd Street and Broadway. It was just north of Manhattan College and west of Van Cortlandt Park, great big park. And it was a great place to go visit.
Mm-hmm.
Had all of that. Country boy going to see skyscrapers and see elevators and escalators. And they had these, what the heck did they call them? Nickelodeon?
The movie viewing?
No. This is where you get a sandwich. You put your nickel or quarter in and open it. it up. You got a ham sandwich, you tuna down here, piece of pie here. It looked like a whole wall, looked like post office boxes. That was a big treat. Then I walked across the Washington Bridge with my cousin. That was a big deal.
What was New York City like in the 1940s?
Yeah. Going down the bus, right, parallel the Hudson River, and part of the Navy fleet was there. And then when you got down to New York, there were ships. The Normandy got fire in New York Harbor. I don't know if you remember that.
I do. I remember reading about that.
Listed there, and I remember seeing that. It was a big thing. And then after the war, they mothballed those ships along the Hudson. Hundreds of ships, butt to butt, next to each other.
Wow.
Oh, it was amazing. My sister, older sister, was working in New York City before she came ill with TB. And she was about World War II or maybe just before. Anyway, she was working in New York City when a B-24 flew into the Empire State Building. And she was at her desk and there.
She saw it.
Yeah, she's sitting at her desk.
Wow.
And heard the big crash, and I mean, looks out there, and there it is. The ass end is sticking out there. But it was exciting going down to see. We didn't make it out to Statue of Liberty. We did go up to the Empire State Building. But one of the things, I'm jumping around here, but mentioning New York City. The centerfold of Beyond Nam Dong, my last book, is when I mention word centerfold, people go, oh man, what's this? I says, it's one of the most beautiful women I've ever met. And then that really perks them up when I say that. And I say, and she was my Latin teacher in high school. And why is she in my book? Because she's just what I said, one of the most beautiful persons I've ever met. She not only taught us Latin, she set the standard for the course and said, you have to pass the course. You have to have a B or better to be a member of the Latin club, or French club, or both clubs, whatever might be the case, or German. She taught all three languages. And she took on the challenge of, in retrospect, it's one of the greatest things I've seen, and I recognized it, and I was able to get her recognized for it at a national level. She, the Latin Club, for some social benefits, but she had a project, and the project was to raise funds by selling Christmas cards, and those funds would support our annual trip from Saugerties, New York to New York City to spend a whole day in New York City. In the morning hours, we get off the bus and eat and see a new part of the city, something new was being constructed or something. Afternoon, we go to a stage play, a popular stage play. Well, I can't remember. Single stage player. And then in the evening we went to an opera. And I remember La Traviata, Madame Butterfly. Barbara Seville. There was three of those. And at the time, we were fascinated going into Metropolitan Opera. We had the bloody nose seats.
Right, sure.
Yeah, that we were up there. And, hey, guys, look over there. Yeah, there. Had peanuts. Bombs away. And some big bosom lady down there in her surround. during the break one time. We'd done that and figured we got away with it. And during the break, we all go back in the hallway and everybody's out there. And I'm standing out there, and this little lady with her, looked like a parasol, she comes walking up, and she looking right at me. She goes, "Pop!" She says, "I saw you!"
She's dropping peanuts on the blouses in the Metropolitan Opera.
She popped me with her little parasol, whatever it was, umbrella, walking stick.
What an experience, though, for you all to go down to New York City.
And to this day, I enjoy, and I'll turn on classical and opera. Mm-hmm. Just the kids say, "Oh God, don't bother Dad. He's he's in one of his modes. Mm-hmm. Listen to that music, you know." And she's still alive.
What's her name?
Eleanor Clements Lent, L-E-N-T-E, was her maiden name. In addition to be a great teacher, her dimension of her great person hit a mother that was totally dependent on her. Her mother was totally blind. So her mother lived with her, walking distance from school always. And sometime after I got back from Vietnam, on the first trip, I got a call one day from the National Education Association. Mm-hmm. And they said, "Donald, we'd like to inform you telephonically, and you receive it in writing, that you've been selected to receive our highest award, the Golden Key Award." And I said, "Ma'am, I believe you have the wrong number. If it's the highest award from the National Education Association, I think you just misdialed it." No. She says, "Well, I suggest just hang up and try again." I said, "We hung up. I went about doing whatever I was doing. The phone rang again. It was the same lady." I said, "Well, hello again." "Yeah." She says, "Well, let me tell you a little about this." She says, we know what you've done, but we don't know about somebody. We want to know what teacher touched your life most to this point in your life." "Oh, that's easy. It's Miss Lent." "Oh, we don't want, no, we don't want you to commit yourself." "Well, it won't change," I says, "but whatever." And so then we got into correspondence. Mm-hmm. One thing led to another. And then at their national convention at Atlantic City, they invited her and her mother and my mother, and I think my brother Paul was there too. And we both received a golden key in a felt box. And then she received a monetary award of several thousand dollars. The local school was going from a single high school to a central, so they no longer, they had a language department now, so she got become the language department head. So that was a little frosting on the cake. And she continued to teach for God, I don't know how many years. She's 94 now.
Wow.
Still, God almighty.
Are you able to see her?
Oh yeah, I see her at least once a year every time we go home. I call her quite often, every other month or so, just chat. Because invariably at a book signing, you know, people be looking through the pictures, "What's your line?" Or they're asking me, what does this mean, De Oppressor Liber? Mm-hmm. And I says, "Well, I do that for two reasons. One, it's the motto for Army Special Forces. Our mission is to liberate the oppressed." "But you said it's for two reasons." I says, "Yeah, the other reason's more important than that." He says, "Well, why?" I says, "That's my way of saluting my old Latin teacher in high school." And there she is. Yeah.
That's neat.
So I tell her about that once in a while, and she gets tickled.
It's a great way to honor her.
Oh yeah, it's really, and she's touched so many people. Everybody remembers her so fondly. We had our 50th high school reunion a few years ago, and guys were getting their heads together, and they contacted me and said, "Hey Roger, how about you ask Miss Lent to be our guest, special guest that night? I said, sure. So I was up home. I went down to see her. And we chit-chatted. I said, by the way, Miss Lent, I said, we'd like you to be our special guest at this, our 50th reunion. She says, Roger, she says, my policy is never to go to a reunion. She says, I didn't know. People always say you show favoritism or something. So.
Spoken like a true teacher.
Yeah. And I says, well, Miss Lent, Eleanor, I'm not leading until you change your mind. So we visited, Norm and I, for an hour. 2 hours went by. And we were still chatting and talking. And we started repeating ourselves. Mm-hmm. And then finally she says, Roger, Norma, under one condition, I will accept your kind invitation to your 50th high school reunion. Norma says, what's that? She says, I want to know who put that weasel in my desk the last day of school. 50 years, she's
gosh.
You've been wondering about who put that weasel.
Was it you?
No, but that night they all fingered me.
Oh, really?
The guy that did it wasn't there. He got fingered. And they still swear, oh, it was me, because I did some other things in high school and throughout school years. Mm-hmm. And snakes and frogs and squirrels and stuff, desks and different parts of the school. But that one I wasn't guilty of. But as far as everybody else is concerned, they got me. I think it was Bob Lizette. I never even found a weasel. Never saw one until that day.
Uh-huh.
I headed out in the hall, and I think why they fingered me, because Bob gave it to me, and I was going around showing it to the girls in the cloakrooms and having them all squeal.
Uh-huh. So they figured it had to be yours.
Yeah, so they... But,
why don't we talk a little bit about your brothers and sisters? Could you describe each one? Talk about who they were.
Yeah, who they were and who they are, and there are some words. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in order of birth, to the best of my knowledge, because there's a couple of them, my sister always claims my brother's older. But anyway, Mary Bernadette is the firstborn, 1925. She enjoyed most of her early years in the privileged part of the family's situation. Really sharp, very intelligent. She went to she didn't go to college, she went to a secretarial school, I guess they had at that time, mm-hmm. in New York City, and worked in New York City. I never knew her very much, because the time I came along, she was off to school and to work. And then she contracted tuberculosis. And I remember we used to go visit and sometimes have to be outside the window. And she received the last rites, extreme unction, at least 3 times in her life that I know. But it got to the point, I guess about the time she stayed in there for years, it seemed like. And then I know when I left home, that was 52. It wasn't till then that she, sometime shortly after that, I think, that she came home, was allowed to leave the hospital. And I think my younger sister had just left too. So she came home, I think, one, because her health stabilized the best it could, and then she would be a companion for mother.
Mm-hmm.
And this would be an empty nest. And that turned out to be a good thing. And in some ways, Bernadette was much like mother. She was definitely like mother from a spiritual dimension. She had a genuine spiritual person, and she felt she's been touched by God in life. That's why she lived to beyond 60, I think. She was near death several times, but her life at home with mother circled about the two of them going to church activities, and then Bernadette would always go to the library. She was an avid reader and always had books at her elbow mm-hmm. to read day and night, and was current on what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. So, but I always felt sad that, you know, she was burdened with the poor health and never had a chance to have her own family, but she certainly enjoyed the all her nieces and nephews. Mm-hmm. Paul was the first son. Paul Augustine Ignatius. He took Ignatius for a confirmation name. And, again, I didn't know Paul much because he was up and gone the time I was around remembering things. Mm-hmm. And then next thing I know, he was... I don't even remember him playing sports in high school. I guess he was kind of... But he was... My earliest recollection really is, you know, him off to the war. Mm-hmm. And then praying extra hard he'd make it home. In those days, we used to follow the war on the front page of the newspapers. It was Albany Times, the New York Knickerbocker, the Daily News, Freeman, was the Kingston newspaper, and the Sobriety's Post. We used to call the Daily Disappointment. But during the war, they'd always have a little block, 2 inches by 2 inches maybe, and it gave the schematic of where the action was. And we followed Africa because Paul landed mm-hmm. and then went with his unit up to Sicily and Italy, and with the 3rd Division. We'd always look for where the 3rd Division patch was represented. Mm-hmm. And we'd follow that. I often now think, gee, it would have been great to just keep all those things and kept scrapbook that way. But we didn't do that. So, and Paul got wounded. I think he had aspirations one day. He was dreaming about the FBI in his youth. Anyway, he came back, went to college at Manhattan College, and that's where we got to see more of him. I still remember him coming home on the weekends with his metal suitcase with straps around it, and that was his laundry.
And, did he talk to you about his war experiences?
No, he didn't talk to us about the war experiences until I had my own. I heard little bits and pieces because some of his buddies would come by. And I remember sometime after the war, great big strapping guy. He was Native American. And Paul and he were out on the front porch, and I was hiding up in the cherry tree just trying to listen. And I listened. They were talking about some of their experiences. And there was... One, they got into hand-to-hand, and I don't remember if the story, if Paul was with him, he may not have been with him, but this guy, the German got the best of him, and they were wrestling, and he lost his dagger, and he says, the only thing I could do, and I bit him. Bit his jugular vein, and I could just see this big guy just taking a chunk out of this guy. And so he lived to tell the story, and I was sitting, I almost falling out of the cherry tree. Yeah, this is I'm going down there and mean to old guy.
It's like, what I bargained for. I didn't mean to hear that.
Yeah. So, but Paul, he went to Manhattan College, Jaspers, under the Christian Brothers. That became an issue later on with my other brother who went to a Jesuit school. And they're mm-hmm. both proclaimed to be the best teachers. Mm-hmm. And so that's a perennial discussion and topic. And in fact, I just talked to Paul the other day, said, what are you doing for Thanksgiving? Thinking he might want to come out. He says, oh, I'm going to Rhode Island. He's my college mate, invite me over every Thanksgiving. he passed away with his wife and children invite me. He says, I'm the godfather of his mm-hmm. classmate's child.
How nice.
So he goes, and it's again an extension of the influence of the church in our lives. Here's a godchild
yes.
who is taken under her wing, this 80-year-old godfather.
That's neat.
And again, it's kind of the hand of God mm-hmm. working. So next is Mike. Paul, because of his wounds, was unable to pass the physical for the FBI, and that's the reason they gave him. So he wouldn't take it no for an answer. So he, always been, because of his injury, he got into the regimen of physical fitness, and to this day, even at age 80, he's to the gym probably 3 times a week. But he steeled himself, and he running practically on one leg, because he stumped the other, passed their tests. And they said, well, the new recruiting is that we're focused on CPAs.
Yeah. Wow.
So that was a disappointment for him. And Paul, I remember, he's private, but he was the sole provider for our family. So as a private, he got an allowance from mother and wherever many were home mm-hmm. as part of his pay. Mm-hmm. And then when he left the Army, he felt he still had some obligations. So he always was the provider. And then as we each left, we all tried to contribute and lessen it on him. But he never took the load off his shoulder. And so he never married, which I think in retrospect, we could have individually or collectively say, hey, come on, Paul, we all chip in. And I know before I met Norma, I was helping out on a routinely monthly basis because mother was there and Bernadette, and I had no means of income.
Right.
So, and Norma, God bless her, she never complained. The years our family grew, still there was always a chunk that went home mm-hmm. before. So Paul became the mainstay. And now he resides in the family home. He's there. Mike was a great baseball player in high school. He's a southpaw.
Yeah.
In fact, I watched him throw more than one single or no hitter. And then went in the Army. Was with the 1st Division, the Big Red One, we called. Because he was a jockstrap, so to speak, athlete, they put him in special services. And he was played for basketball, and I don't know about baseball, maybe too. Mm-hmm. But he was in Berlin at the end of the war. Mm-hmm. Got to tell him one story. He was on the honor guard. At major headquarters in Berlin. They all had to be 6 feet or over, and that's why they were selected. And the MPs would man the switchboard for the command section. And so he was manning it one night, and his buddies back there annoying him by playing on his guitar. So Mike plugs in, and there's Eisenhower to Patton. So connects him, turns around and tells his buddy, he says, hey, shut the hell up back there. When he did, he hit the switch and it opened the circuit. So he says, shut the hell up. And then Mike's going, yeah. What'd you say, Ike? What'd you say? He says, I didn't sleep that night. He says, I swore I was going to get court-martialed the next morning. But nothing ever happened of it.
Especially between those two. Yeah. Oh, Eisenhower.
Yeah. So that was a tale. And whether that was embellished a little bit or not, I don't know, but it was always a great tale. You got to say, yeah, he had the unique opportunity to tell two generals to shut the hell up at the same time. But, yeah, I remember when he came home, he bought some souvenirs. And we had big German flags with the swastikas. Mm-hmm. God almighty, I took one out and I waved it over the front porch of the house. And man,
oh, gosh.
I was going to start a riot in the neighborhood.
Gosh.
The Big Red One is one of the most famous Army divisions and has a great, great history. And as it turned out, two of my sons served and were trained with the Big Red One, partially at Fort Riley, Kansas. And Mike went on to Loyola of the South in New Orleans, and business economics major. And married, and then Michael Edward Donlan, Michael E. Donlan III. And he raised his family of nine.
Wow.
Yeah, you heard that expression, dinks?
Yes.
Double income, no kids?
Mm-hmm.
Mike was a dink of another culture. Double income, nine kids.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wonderful, wonderful family. The sad part, his wife, as she stopped working out the home, was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's. Mm. Had 3-year struggle. Never enjoyed a day being empty nester or sad. They struggled. So her children, who have gone on to become doctors and successful businessmen and other things, and find a way to touch in their community people or stimulate activities that will be fundraisers for the Lou Gehrig's.
Okay.
So Mike, and he lives in their home in Basking Ridge, New Jersey. They're an affluent community, but he moved there when he was working in that area and chose to stay there. It was difficult because he traveled to and from, but it was the best place for the children's education. They were stable. Good community, mm-hmm. good opportunities. Most of them went to, what's the school in Jersey?
Rutgers.
Rutgers. Good. And now they're doing all kinds of things. If you ever come across the Morton Steakhouse.
Morton Steakhouse.
The Steakhouse, Morton's. Morton's of Chicago. Go in there and use my nephew's name, Mike Donlan. Tell him, Uncle Roger sent Mike. Mike runs one of the regions.
Okay.
They're two guy. He's really a great guy.
Done well.
Yeah. And Mike's kids, and now his grandchildren. So we get to see him a couple times a year. Tried like heck. He's got some health problems. He wasn't able to join. My brother Paul, we convinced he ought to celebrate his 80th birthday with us in Kansas. So we flew him out and then got another brother and sister-in-law from Florida to come mm-hmm. up and try to get Mike. But he was shingles, flattened him out. He wasn't in a travel mode, so. But.
I think we have time for one more.
Yeah.
If you want to do one more sibling.
After Mike comes Jack. Jack was he was a bigger, probably the biggest athlete. Basketball and soccer were his forte in high school. Really personable guy, always joking. They called him, his nickname in high school was the Governor.
It's a great nickname.
And the Governor at our time was a guy named Dewey. And the Governor when I was born was a guy named Roosevelt. So we had, and they drove by the front yard all the time. That's to Albany, New York. John Dillinger drove by there also. The highway patrol set the machine gun in the front yard.
Really?
Yeah.
Gosh.
It was an interesting intersection.
Yes, yes it is.
But Jack, and he was the big athlete, very popular. He went into Air Force after college, after high school. He worked, I think, around town for a while. I went to the Air Force, put a stint in the Air Force, I don't know how many years, got out, came back home. I remember his way of helping at home, he bought mother the first refrigerator. It had ice box. He might have even got the first television, our first telephone. We didn't have, never had a telephone or television or refrigerator. We had an ice box where you put the ice and empty the water. I don't know why we never put a drain in that thing. Maybe that was a way to keep control of us. And somebody had to empty the water or mop it up afterwards. You're late. But I remember once I was a kid, I had a case of the mumps. And I was in quarantine in the room on top of the stairs. And Jack was home with a couple of his buddies. And they came upstairs. And I stuck my head out and they had a big old rag around. I don't know if you've seen a case of the mumps where
you
don't swell up like
this.
And they had, I don't know what they had around me. And I stuck my head out. Those guys were just coming with this stuff. And they crashed down the staircase. Luckily, they didn't break the rail or something. But they wouldn't come. A guy named Ricky Way. Where that name came from, and Neil Cox were with Jack. But Jack was a fun guy. When he came home and he worked, and he was one of his closest high school buddies was a real serious physical fitness athlete, weightlifter, and all that. And I'd phased out of chickens, converted the chicken coop, which was once a garage, into a weightlifting room. Jack said, "You help me, Raj, I'll buy you ice cream." And I'd be his spotter. So I'd be his spotter when he'd be pumping weight, and when he wasn't around, I'd go out and try to do something. But and he worked for some company, but he lost both fingers in a press, index fingers up to there.
You're indicating, for those who can't see, the main middle knuckle.
Yeah, that's all he's got is that stump right there.
In a press accident?
Yeah, he was working in some plant. And he jokes around in different ways he lost. But then he didn't. He was lost for a while. He wanted to go back in the Air Force. And when he was in the Air Force, he was in the medical, he was a dental hygienist. And their recruiter says, "No way, unless you can get somebody in the Air Force to say you're the best guy since peanut butter." So he wrote his old boss, who by then became a colonel. And the guy said, "Hell yes, bring him back from over there, and I'll take him." He said, "I've never had a guy work so hard and so proficiently. And I don't care if he's missing five fingers." And he went back and he spent a career. And of course, the patients. Oh, one guy really got mad at me one day. Look what happened. And you won't believe his wife came in the next day and look what happened to you.
So he had a good humor about it.
Oh, God, yeah. He's crazy. But he retired. They had two sons. One is his career in the Navy. Another son is up around Raleigh, Durham, and we're going to be traveling through there. And Brian called Norma the other day. He says, "Don't tell anybody, but I'm going to take you and Roger out for dinner the night you're going to be staying in Raleigh to catch your plane. And Mom and Dad are coming. They don't know you're going to be there."
Oh, how nice.
So it's going to be an early Thanksgiving. So that's kind of a, and Jack is, he's his hobby in retirement, he's a master gardener, serious one, and does a lot in his community. And he's very active, and he's a Knight of Columbus, and very active in his parish. And my other brother, Gerard, who was also in the Air Force, mm-hmm. married a Philippine girl. Mm-hmm. They separated, but all his family are in Florida, Panama City area. Mm-hmm. So Jack oversees all of Gerard's children and grandchildren now. Wow. So he's got a very active life.
Wow.
And Fran. They ran their, when they retired from the Air Force, they bought this little cinder block house mm-hmm. when he was stationed in Florida. Mm-hmm. And they kept it through their career. So when he retired, he had paid for it. Mm-hmm. Went down. Hand of God. Lady next door had the same type of house, identical. Little old widow. Nobody in life, nobody to take care of her, mm-hmm. no living relatives. And they befriended her, loved her like a mother, mm-hmm. did everything, and they became the best of friends. She passes, leaves the house to them. So now they got two properties. Mm-hmm. They rent this one out. They got the hand of God, just saying thanks. One of the things my mother used to say is, don't worry, help somebody. You give something, it'll come back to you 100-fold. That's happened to all of us one way or another. Mm-hmm. We've seen that. So Jack, yeah. And they travel to Spain once or twice a year because their son in the Navy is stationed over there. Mm-hmm. Likely going to retire there too. He married a Spanish girl.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they have a family. So they go there to see the grandchildren. That's a big thing. Grandchildren will make you go any place in the world. Now I saw a bumper sticker. But grandchildren are so great. If we knew they were so great, we would have had them first.
Well, sir, I think we're out of time this morning. So thank you very much for
joining us. Yeah, thank you for your patience.